Radio Ghana.
And live from our national studios here in Accra, and also networking on all our regional FM stations together with functioning on the internet at www.gbcghana.com. We say welcome to Behind the News, where we speak to the newsmakers and experts. My name is Kingsley Odinchere. For tonight, we have on the headlines, injecting vim into SADA activities, what has been happening so far, helping people with disability, from talk to action, taking up the oil discussions, TUC gets to action, its unionization, the agenda, and then looking at Africa's dilemma with foreign interventions. Is there a way out? Behind the News, and as usual, we encourage you to be very active listeners. You can send in your text and comments to the line 026-441-8767. We'll be talking about SADA very soon. President Mills today decried the numerous foreign interventions on the African continent, saying the West, which used to dictate the economic and political path of the continent, are now acting by directly intervening in internal affairs. The president, continuing his visit to Canada, said the trend must stop because the future repercussions may not be good. Foreign interventions on the continent are not a new phenomenon. US, France and Britain have lately led missions into Cote d'Ivoire and Libya. The AU and leaders on the continent have not been vocal as they should. So has the president comments broken the ice, or it has come too late? Dr. Nii Alabi is a communications consultant who once consulted for the AU. He has joined us with his views on the president's comments on foreign interventions. Good evening, sir. Hello, Dr. Nii Alabi. We seem to have a little challenge on the line. We'll quickly try to re-establish contact with Dr. Nii Alabi and get his comments on what the president is saying. Behind the News, live from Radio Ghana. Sincere apologies for that trip on the line. But we have joining us now Dr. Nii Alabi, a communications consultant. Dr. Alabi, good evening, and you are welcome.
Good evening.
Yes. President Mills is making this comment at this moment, and some are saying it is coming too late when so many things had gone, or so much water had gone under the bridge. Do you think it's too late?
Well, what do we exactly mean by too late? I mean, changes in one's views, perceptions, changes in one's attitude, and even in policy, you know, something that quite normal. As long as they are positive changes, I think they are part and parcel of the normal evolution of society. The worst scenario would be that we keep on repeating the very bad things that we have done over the years. I think that the language that the president has been using, maybe on these occasions, is a kind of language that strikes a chord with a lot of progressives everywhere they are, that yes, the time has come for us to be telling those so-called development partners of ours, who are actually our detractors in every sense of the word, that the time has come for us to wean ourselves indeed from this cup-in-hand policy of taking a pittance from them, for them to be dictating to us what to do with our lives. There is empirical evidence that, for example, the World Bank has been part of a problem as far as Africa development is concerned. In 1993, thereabout, Senegal, for example, the economy was thrown into total disorder because of World Bank projections in the fishery industry. And you know that fishing is a key, you know, sector in Senegal's economy. And because of these false projections, of course, there was a lot of problems that the economy had to face. And as soon as this happened, the normal thing for them is to wash their hands off. Another classic example that I would want the world to bear in mind is that there was a World Bank resident director in the former Zaire called Blumenthal, who has written a book, which I have read time without number, who was telling Washington, that is the World Bank, that all the money is being made available to the government of Mobutu Sese Seko were not going to the national coffers. They were not used for development purposes or for the purpose for which they were supposed to be used, and that these monies were going into the private coffers of Mobutu Sese Seko. Blumenthal was, nobody listened to him. Dai didn't need that money at the time. Later on, Dai was classified as one of the most indebted countries, you know, in Africa. Where did the money go? And this is something that will have to force us to look at our partnership with these so-called development partners. These are just two examples which will tell you that they are not our development partners. Indeed, they will want to continue to push us where we are so that every day they will call the shots. This is important. So I am enthused about the president's, even though that's come a bit too late, at the time that Ghana is saddling itself with too many debts, debts that are hardly sustainable from my own illiterate economic point of view, but, you know, very worrying debts that we are, you know, contracting left, right, and center. So, well, if it has come too late and the president is going to back his words with action at home, then I think it's okay.
Dr. Alabi, you've raised these concerns, but some are saying that Africa, as talking about the AU, has maintained a policy of non-interference. Has this really worried the situation?
Indeed. If you look at the Constitutive Act of the African Union, which replaced, you know, the OAU Charter, there is a tremendous movement away from this concept of non-interference in the internal affairs of member countries, especially with the advent of this doctrine of responsibility to intervene, responsibility to protect, you know, which was what the international community invoked to, as it were, you know, intervene in Libya, even though there were other hidden factors that, you know, were at play. So, it does not also suggest that the AU should be supine. And when there is butchery going on, when there is the kind of tyranny going on in a country like, you know, Libya at that time, the AU have to turn a blind eye to it. Couldn't they have called Gaddafi to order to say that, look, what you are doing is indeed an embarrassment, an aberration, and we would want you to... But there was no pressure brought to bear on him for the simple reason that, of course, some of these countries who could stand up were also taking largesse from him. And apart from that, you see, there was no united approach to the issue of Libya. Even when it came to Cote d'Ivoire, how on earth could a country like France take upon itself the responsibility of tracking down the ex-president Laurent Gbagbo, because the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, wrote a personal letter to the French Foreign Minister, Alain Juppé, to the President, that is Sarkozy, asking for France to spearhead the hunt for Gbagbo and his eventual capture. Is this not direct meddlesomeness, direct interference by the so-called international community? So I think the AU actually showed how weak it was, how really amorphous, how supine it was. And this is a lesson. At the end of the day, it became an embarrassment when South Africa dissented, disagreed with the position of, say, Nigeria. And these two countries are, you know, some of the biggest contributors. And, you know, when there is dissent on key issues of this nature, it affects the unity, indeed, of action of the African Union. But I know that this will not be replicated again. This is going to serve as a lesson to guide the running of the AU in future. So the non-interference issue actually is a non-issue.
Dr. Alabi, with these developments and the call by the president, do you see things changing? Because even after Gaddafi's exit, people are saying that no problem has been solved. You look at Libya, it is still a problem. Even Egypt is still presenting a challenge. And you cannot say that this is the time that people can shout hooray yet.
No. It is not yet hooray. Nobody in their right assessment should think that, yes, because Gaddafi is of the scene, that Gaddafi, you know, has been removed, Libya's problems are solved. Libya, looking at the ethnic composition of the population, is going to have to grapple with internal problems. And the AU would have to come in early enough so that these foreign predators, when I mean foreign predators, I am talking for the contract seekers from the United States, from the European Union nations to come and, as it were, you know, share the booty of the war. But this is the time for the AU to stand up. But as I am saying, the AU has its own challenges, which is challenges of resources. One key project of the AU, which has been sort of dragging for years, is this African Standby Force. If I tell you that the bulk of the finances have to come from the European Union, you'd be surprised. It means that we do not really have the resources to keep going. And this has also weakened, in fact, the resolve of the AU to be up and doing. But I know as more and more states learn to contribute to an important organization such as the AU, instead of going to spend money to fund the election of the Sarkozy's of this world, we would be able to get a more functioning, a more proactive African Union.
Well, Dr. Alabi, we've heard the call by President Mills. I know there may be other African leaders on the continent who might be thinking that same way. Do you think that they need to really call a meeting to discuss these emerging problems?
It's very important, but meetings are on and on and on. I mean, the last AU summit that took place at in Malabo, you know, which looked at issues affecting the continent, including the youth development and so on. They have been talking, but the issue is actually actualizing certain good decisions that are taken at the highest level of the heads of state and government, you know, meetings, which is the summit. To put them into practice is what has become a major problem. And over the years, the AU has not been short of coming out with really good and brilliant ideas. But implementation, as has always been the case, is the problem. So I think talking is important. But let us see greater commitment on the part of these leaders, because some of them, if you look at a person like Paul Biya of Cameroon, he's been there for how many years? Over 30 years. And this man hardly spends half of the year in his own country. He spends most part of his, you know, time in Europe and France and so on and so forth. Is this the kind of leader who cares about what happens to Africa, let alone to his country, let alone Africa? No, and he's not the only one. Denis Sassou Nguesso of Congo, the same kind of thing you can say about him. Look at what is happening in Egypt. The military are so cocooned in their position of still stringing on to power that people are pouring to the streets again and say, this is not what the revolution was all about. Where is the African Union in all this? And I know that it is not for a lack of consent, but rather a lack of the means to move into action.
Yeah. So moving into action has been the real issue here. Do you sometimes want to put it down to poverty or perhaps the people seeking their own interests at times. This is not in my interest, looking at what the way I'm dealing with a foreign power. So let me just keep quiet instead of making an intervention for them to next time threaten me.
Yeah, I think that the issue of poverty, we cannot run away from it. We have been living with it. We are going to continue to live with it for a very long time. But poverty does not mean that we should abandon our self-respect, you know, and let people dictate to us. That is why, if we go back to some of the major declarations of the great Osage for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, preferring, you know, poverty to, you know, subservience and so on, it all comes down to the fact that you need to be able to assume and guard jealously your own sovereignty. Some of these countries are really states that geopolitically should not be in existence as nation states because they do not have what it takes to survive on their own. So, you know, their sovereignty virtually has been owned to in the process of bootlicking of the bigger masters, probably those who colonized them. If you look at countries like, you know, Niger, Chad, many other, you know, sort of countries, the Central African Republic, you can see that these countries are so pauperized. If you look at the UNDP Human Development Report Index, and, you know, the least developed countries, most of them come from Africa. Why should it be so? But this does not mean that we should abandon the fight to assume certain responsibilities. No, but always looking up to them for succor means that we will never be able to stand up to them. That is why I am saying once again that in terms of the language that President Mills has used, I am enthused. But my big, big, big question is that language going to be backed by action on the ground for him to tell the development partners that, look, the time has come for us to let us, you know, suffer in our poverty. We will get there if we are prepared to make sacrifices as some other Asian nations did, you know, making sacrifices. Are we prepared for that? We are too often, you know, interested in looking for the cheap options, you know, but it will never help us.
Okay.
Yes, it will never help us.
Dr. Nia Lavi, we want to thank you very much for your time this evening.
You're welcome.
Nia Lavi is a communications consultant and also once consulted for the AU, sharing its views on the call on African leaders to be very bold in championing the cause of the continent. Behind the news, we are moving on. Vice President John Dramani Mahama must have put a lot of smiles on the faces of persons with disability when he issued a stern warning to those responsible for issuing building permits to halt permits for public buildings that are not disability-friendly. For years, public buildings have been constructed without the disabled in mind. This is in sharp contrast to what pertains in the advanced countries where hospitals, schools, churches, toilets, and indeed most public facilities make provision for the disabled. We want to explore the issues further. We try to get in touch with the chairman of the Disability Council, Andrew Okankwe, but we've not succeeded so far. But Alex Williams is a member of the Ghana Blind Union. He's joined us on the line. Good evening, Alex.
Good evening, Kingsley, and good evening to your wonderful listeners.
Yes. You were at the forum. What were some of the things that really touched you?
Oh, thanks once again, Kingsley. I think today at the forum, a lot of things touched me. One, and, you know, the first and foremost was Roland and Gambiri's contribution towards wanting to develop the opportunities that exist for persons with disabilities in this country. Roland has indeed identified the in some key areas and is trying to partner with government. I was so excited that the Ministry of Employment and Social Welfare have taken that wonderful initiative, trying to equip persons with disabilities with employable skills, looking in the field of IT, i.e. computer assembling, mobile phone accessories, and it's assembling. And these, looking at the exigencies of the time, are relevant skills and tools that persons with disabilities require to fit adequately into our current society. And that was properly linked up with the the president's call through the Vice President John Mahama, and that indeed all building permits should not be issued without showing proof of making accessibility and room for accessibility for persons with disabilities. Now, that really ties in to the entire project that the government is embarking upon, because one of the issues that is used in discriminating against persons with disabilities in this country is the issue of accessibility. Some of employers will tell you that, look, we are not ready to take you on because we do not think you can access our building. If indeed we do take you on, we might face some fine whatsoever. So the Vice President actually demanding that as of today, building permits that are issued should be issued only when they show proof of accessibility for persons with disabilities, has indeed come at the right time. However, we still have some more years to go regarding the moratorium that was stated in the Persons with Disabilities Act 715 that was passed in 2006 that indicated that from as of 2006 all buildings that were built should have been built looking at accessibility issues with regarding persons with disabilities. Unfortunately, most builders or contractors have understood that moratorium as saying that buildings should only be made accessible in 2016, which isn't the case. And I'm happy that the Vice President made it explicitly clear that as of today, that shouldn't happen. Now, I would be so glad if the government could go a step further to even look at road construction and its accessibility to persons with disability in this country. Because once you are going to get them employed now, once you are given employable skills, if employers are ready to take them on, one issue is how easy can they move from one point to the other. Our current way of constructing roads in this country, most at times, do not seem to be friendly for persons with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And one way in which they can really help us to make sure that we are able to access the environment appropriately is making roads accessible. I mean, quickly, I will recall the effort that the MTTU with the roads and highways are trying to make in trying to get traffic lights more functional. Next year, we hear that they are going to have some cameras placed by the traffic lights. We believe that this is going to be a wonderful innovation. But what they shouldn't forget is making these traffic lights as well very accessible. And by way of making the traffic lights accessible, especially for blind and deaf users, it only means giving these traffic lights the ability to beep at key moments or the ability to give certain indicators at key moments, which aren't extensive ventures to delve into. So it does sound like today persons with disabilities had a real honey spilled in their tea.
Yeah.
And we hope it's the beginning of a better future for persons with disabilities in this country.
Yes, Alex, following up on what you just said, it's something important. When we talk about persons with disability, you know, there are different categories of such people. You've just mentioned the blind and the deaf, and it's one category. There are those who are physically challenged and all. When talking about the issues, on some occasions, do you think all are lumped together, and so what should be done? It's not necessarily done to cater for the different interests.
Thanks, Kingsley, very much for this question as well. the case usually is what you've just stated. When we are talking about persons with disabilities, we lump all of them together. And then that makes it, you know, difficult for us to see what the separate issues are and what the real difficulties are, how to deal with the challenges. For instance, if we talk about accessibility, currently when we talk about accessibility to public buildings, most people only think about ramps or heavy doors. So that if you go to a public building and they have built a ramp, they say, oh, we've made a place so accessible. Everybody forgets that particular level of accessibility, it has to do with catering for the accessibility needs of persons with physical disability. Now, no one talks about a person with low vision. Low vision accessibility issues have to do with making sure that there are contrasting colors in the public building so as to assist the low vision person, the person who cannot see properly, to be able to tell one point from another by the way the place has been painted or colored. For the totally blind person, it has to do with constructing of dwarf walls or pavement around your building, making elevators have braille labels, as well as some sound feedback. There are different levels of accessibility when you go to the hospitals that the vice president mentioned. Deaf persons, for instance, are able to access these hospitals and they can walk in. But if they get in there, how are they able to communicate with the nurses and the doctors when there are no sign language interpreters? These are the various issues that we need to keep our eyes on and then make sure that they are dealt with. I will give you a good example even in relation to this particular project. The Minister of Employment and Social Welfare, Honorable E.T. Mensah, did mention today in his speech that blind and partially sighted persons had a specific concern that they had not necessarily been taken care of in this 21 million Ghana cedis project. And that was specifically because we felt that we are looking at ICT for persons with disabilities. Blind persons come in a very special way because though every person with disability can access any computer, we would have to access it through the screen reader in addition to having other skills that are not common with the usual computer user. So if we were not brought on board at the very early stage, we felt that it was going to be difficult for the government to actually just push us in at the last end. But the Honorable Minister did indicate that they had taken cognizance of our grievances, mm-hmm. and that they were going to actually make sure that the computer centers that exist currently in this country that train blind and partially sighted persons shall be further equipped to participate in the rolling out of this project.
Yeah. Alex, you work with blind technologies, things that really support those who are visually challenged and even completely blind. Do you think some of you should be getting into places where perhaps with all that you know, you assist almost every organization to be able to serve your interest as well as that of other challenged people?
I really believe that it is high time, you know, we make known to the Ghanaian public that, first of all, it is possible for persons with visual impairment to participate in the usual day-to-day business affairs of this country by using the computer. And it is important that we also make known that the services of the Ghana Blind Union's Computer Learning Center is available to all and sundry, and we are ready to move wheresoever in this country to assist employers as well as employees who have visual challenges to get well acquainted with their computers, give them the relevant skills, and then get them moving. I think we no longer have the excuse that these things are not available. The services are available. The Ghana Blind Union is an NGO as well as a pressure group. We do not necessarily charge fully for our services. Once you make us aware, we are ready to even train the IT staff of the various establishments to be well acquainted with some of these issues so that they would have hands-on experience in dealing with them whensoever they crop up. We have done them with a few establishments like Unique Bank as well as Newman's Gold Mine. and we believe that others should also follow suit. Our services are available, I should say, at all times.
We want to thank you very much, Alex Williams, for joining us this evening.
Thank you too, Kinsley, for that.
Alex is a member of the Ghana Blind Union and an expert in blind technologies. Behind the news, live on Radio Ghana, and these quick tests. Dr. Alabi is right. The Western nations are detractors and not developing partners. Combat titles from Tamale said so. And Baba Musa UDS is saying the call by President Mills is a bold and laudable one. For how long should African leaders continue to bow to the so-called financial giants like IMF and World Bank to the detriment of Africans? The development of the northern savanna areas of this country has been seen by many development experts as a way of addressing the overall development of Ghana. Thus, when the Savanna Accelerated Development Authority, SADA, was announced as an agency to facilitate the process, the move was seen as providing some hope. However, for some, the process has delayed in getting onto the ground and feel disappointed. Yet, officials of SADA believe that they have been working on the sustainability of the initiative as a long-term agency to address the needs of the areas covered by SADA. What has happened so far with the SADA program? Is it behind schedule? Mr. Gilbert Idi is the Chief Executive Officer of Savanna Accelerated Development Authority and has now joined us on the line. Good evening, sir.
Good evening to our listeners.
Do you agree with those who say the SADA initiative has been slow in meeting the expectations of the people?
No, I don't think that can be very right. You know, the problem most of us have is we conceptualize what we think SADA is and what SADA should be doing. And then on the basis of it, we use that as a yardstick to determine, you know, what SADA is doing and then begin to, you know, draw those conclusions. Because SADA, you know, should be seen as an agency that has come, you know, to, you know, bridge the gap between, the developmental gap between the SADA zone and the rest of the country. And that kind of development normally will take a very long time. You know, SADA is not the first of its kind. In some other countries, some jurisdictions, like you have in the UK, South Africa, India, you have regional development authorities, you know, that take, but the stories that we have about regional development authorities, we're trying to see the one which has examples for SADA, and we realize that most of them have been operating for the past 30 years, you know. So, and for SADA to take off, certainly there are certain benchmarks that must be put in place, you know, before actual implementation on the ground starts.
Yeah. So where is the program as of now?
What's happening is, as of now, the program has, you know, there is a board that has been put in place. The CEO, who I was just appointed a little over 3 weeks back, and I want to be able to recruit some technical staff who will appoint, support the CEO in the implementation of the SADA agenda. You know, then we have also constituted the, Stakeholders Consultative Committee, which we hope to inaugurate very soon. But immediately after taking office, the first thing that I did was to be able to put some framework in place through the support of DFID and technical assistance. We produced, you know, our first strategy, you know, on the procedure that we want to be able to adopt in order to implement the SADA plan, and that is the business plan. So the business plan today that we decided to present to our donor conference with the hope that they can also make in their inputs, and then we'll put all that together and finally have a blueprint for implementation.
Yeah.
So that's where we are as of now.
Okay, so we cannot point to anything on the ground as SADA related for now.
Oh, there are quite a number of things that one can mention. For instance, there is this Millennium Village project, which is under SADA. You know, the Millennium Village project, you know, it's a project that is being funded by DFID, you know, at the instance of SADA, that seeks to bring about achievement of Millennium Development Goals in two adjoining districts of West Mambursi and then South Bulusa, you know, with communities that constitute a cluster of villages of about 30,000 people. You know, that project, we expect they will be taking off, but they are supposed to have recruited a team leader and to take off by 1st January. Now, through the support of UNDP, we've also been able to launch a housing initiative, you know, and that was at Majeri sometime last week. Then during the time of the floods, you know, the team that was on the ground, you know, reacted through the instance of His Excellency, the Vice President, to be able to mitigate the effect of the drought by supporting families, put up, you know, farms, say that income from it, you know, can put them back on, you know, on course to be able to meet their subsequent economic responsibilities. So, but these are off-the-cuff kind of interventions, you know, they are not the mainstream activities of what, you know, SADA, you know, actually setting out to do. It is now that we have this, the business plan that tells specifically what we want to do. But otherwise, these are the areas. And for many people, when they want to determine what SADA is doing, they expect that the biggest problem that we have currently in the SADA area is youth unemployment. And people think that by now they should be bringing in applications for employment and SADA will start employing them. But unfortunately, the design of SADA itself is not to be an employer. SADA is not a direct implementer. SADA seeks to achieve certain goals and objectives through working with other people, facilitating, coordinating, leverage, you know, and coordinate. Those are the roles that SADA, you know, will be playing. But unfortunately, you know, people are misjudging SADA.
Yeah. So would you say, as some are suggesting, that SADA is financially challenged? That is why it is not able to do all that it wants to do?
No, I think that hasn't even kick-started yet. It hasn't started yet because when the drought situation arose, you know, the Ministry of Finance and Economic Planning reacted immediately by releasing 8 million Ghana cedis, you know, possibly for that. And now that the chief executive is in place and there's every indication that we're ready to take off, the ministry has released the balance of the 30 million cedis to us and now has, captured in the current budget another allocation of 30 million to us, in addition to the long-term investment capital of 200 million, you know, which the ministry will make good to SADA.
Yeah.
So I don't think that the problem of SADA is an issue of resource constraint.
Mr. Edi, will you please hold on quickly for us? Bernard Mona is the General Secretary of the People's National Convention and has been very passionate about SADA any time it is mentioned. We have him joining us on the line. Good evening, Bernard.
Good evening, sir.
You have been following the SADA discussions over a period. What do you see with the recent developments?
I just think that government has been playing with the lives of the people, and that if you take that there is a critical years of denial, deprivation, and neglect, particularly for people of northern extraction and the northern zone, there cannot be any excuse that after having identified that the area has been neglected, that has suffered serious slavery, it suffers colonialism, and that the total effect is the current huge levels of underdevelopment of the area. All governments have identified this and are making frantic efforts. The MPP identified it and put what they call the Northern Development Fund as what they were going to implement. The NDC identified and put what they call the Savannah Accelerated Development Plan, so as to be able to bridge the gap between the north and the south. And what we have seen over the years that the NDC have come into office is piecemeal submission. First, it was a 5 million. Second, it was 25 and now 30 million. As if the areas and the concerns are of little importance to them. Indeed, in the action year budget, you recall that there was no budgetary allocation that was made on SADA. And what we heard was that there were going to be a donor conference in order to overcome this. That donor conference is yet to come since the action year has already elapsed. If you also recall, the China loan that was taken, it was our expectation that some amount of money will be dedicated to the SADC area so that we'll be able to overcome the development challenge. That too was not realized. And so if they read a 2012 budget, for us, the final budget of the NDC, and then they simply put a 30 million budget on it, it means that they have shown little commitment to the SADC area.
Yeah, Bernard, let me come in here. What do you make of the explanation that it is taking time to put in structures, because this wouldn't be a government-related but a long-term agency to cater for the development?
I can't understand it in any way. What is not government-related? The huge development gap that afflicts the people is government-related. It took the government of the Gold Coast at the time to ensure that slavery was manifested and therefore caused the gap that exists. It took the government of the Gold Coast to manifest colonialism. It must be government that will ensure that we are able to bridge the gap.
I'm asking, Farah, you didn't get the question.
Should abdicate its responsibility.
Bernard,
there cannot be an agency established by government and government say that that agency has no, it has no hand in that.
Government, government in this case meaning spanning different governments and not just for one particular government to do. So the structure should be in place to make that agency act that way.
Which are the structures that have for the past 4 years cannot be put in place? What kind of structures are they talking about? That the structures have to last for more than 4 years?
You've asked every question, but let me quickly go to Mr. Gilbert Edie. Maybe he can help respond to that one. Mr. Edie,
you've
heard the concerns of Bernard Mona. He wants things done quickly.
Yeah, I've heard Bernard Mona's concerns, and I think I share his sentiments. But I think that if Bernard Mona wants to face the problem, it will go back to pre-independence. And indeed, when the colonial administration was about handing over, it recognized this problem about the disparity between the North and the South, and indeed made some allocation of funding that would be used to bridge the gap between the North and the South under the Nkrumah administration. Nkrumah did what he could do at the time with the Northern Scholarship and all those things. But since after Nkrumah, with the unstable economic, I mean, political situation in the country, it appears the idea of bridging the gap between the North and the South has fallen on deaf ears since from that period. So it is now that with the stability, political stability, governments are now thinking that, look, this problem is real and something has to be done about it. But the mere fact that it is such a very serious problem in itself does not mean that once you will not need to plan in order to be able to address the problem. And certainly, planning takes time. And for me, I think it is better to plan and do things properly rather than doing them half-heartedly just for the political, you know, purposes of saying that, look, we are reacting, knee-jerk reaction and all that.
Yeah.
I find it difficult to agree with that.
Yeah. But Mr. Eddie, even from what Bernard has said, it appears the people in the area sometimes are not so much aware about whatever is going on. Is there a communication challenge with SADC?
Yeah. Thank you very much. I think I couldn't agree with you more on this issue. Indeed, during the donor conference, it came out very prominently, you know, by some of our donors, and to the extent that we think we must have a communication strategy established almost immediately to be able to inform people appropriately. I think part of the problem is a lot of people are just thinking of what the problem is and forgetting about the need to be able to communicate well with the people, what exactly the situation is and what is being done and all that. And I quickly will accept that, yes, it is a problem that we have accepted and we want to move as fast as possible. And with people like Bernard Mona, I'll be very happy if they can help us, you know, in that direction. Bernard is one person that I respect.
Okay. Let me quickly go to him to maybe see how he can come in with that one. Bernard.
Chief.
Yes, you are still on the line. You've heard Mr. Gilbert Edie, and he's acknowledging the fact that perhaps people have not been made aware about whatever is going on. How do you come in? Yes.
I think that my senior brother, Gilbert Edie, and others, I can appreciate the challenge with him that he is the chief executive. He is associated with the ruling government, and therefore criticism of the piecemeal manner they are attending to the problems of the North will not sit well with him, particularly given his position. I can grant that. Master, take the 2012 budget statement and tell me anywhere you can find Shea Butter, Shea Nut, or anything related to that industry. Clearly nothing. And we think that, look, this is almost the cuckoo of the northern sector. That is an industry that we could harness to be able to grow our nation. That if cuckoo alone is grown at 14%, and you mention zero, and we are calling for the establishment of a shea nut or shea butter board. And then we have SADA, and they treat us with the disdain, government after government. I cannot accept that planning and putting in structures can take more than 4 years. I mean, if you take 4 years to do planning alone, Master, how many years will it take you to implement?
Talking about foundations, Bernard, we want to thank you very much for your time and raising some of the other concerns.
Thank you for having me.
Bernard Mona is the General Secretary of the People's National Convention. So, Mr. Eddy, following from your meeting today, what are you going to do to allow the people to see that there is something happening on the ground immediately?
Like, as I told you earlier on, you know, we appreciate this communication gap, and we will try to see as much as possible how to be able to address the issue of a communication strategy, you know, in order to be able to explain to people exactly what the situation on the ground is. But sincerely speaking, like Bernard was talking about, you know, it needs participation by all to be able to address these our northern problems. And if people are ignorant, then it means that it will not provide them with the opportunity to be able to submit their contributions in order to be able to forge ahead. So certainly we want to address this issue of communication alongside, you know, issues of growth, you know, modernizing agriculture and addressing issues of rural transport and all those things. Very soon, I think that Mona and Co will realize that, you know, they were just being, you know, skeptical about what SADA is about, and SADA will want to prove a point in the not too distant future.
Okay. So have you put timelines to whatever you want to do from now?
No. What we have done, we have written now is a business plan. Now we want to be able to move the process forward into a work plan. It is when we translate the business plan to a work plan that we'll be able to put time frames.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gilbert Eddy, for your time too.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That is the Chief Executive Officer of the Savannah Accelerated Development Authority. But Behind the News will be monitoring progress in the area and then getting you informed as to what is happening. As this Donla is saying in this test, we Ghanaians cannot move forward without changing our attitude. Ghanaians should put Mother Ghana first before any political party's interest. God save us. And JK Woman Pondown, let's all support SADA to become fruitful to help our brothers in the northern sector. NDC should spare us with their propaganda. SADA will never see the light of day. Sham Yendi said so. We hope the SADA program will help more northerners. AU Farouk sent that one. And Mohammed Naniwa, the government must be serious and fulfill its part of the promise to SADA before donors come to our aid. We northerners are not happy. Behind the News, live on Ubuntu 96.5 and also on Sunrise Radio Koforidua. Behind the News, just when many thought the discussions on reaping maximum benefits from Ghana's oil fine was settling, the Ghana Trade Union Congress is pushing for more action on that front. The GTUC is getting different sectors of the economy to take up discussions so that the country will be adequately represented and its workers will also benefit from whatever is coming out of the oil fine. We have joining us on the line now Prince Asafoje, a researcher with the GTUC, to tell us precisely what the GTUC is doing about this. Good evening, Prince.
Good evening.
Yes. What is the GTUC's concern about the oil sector presently?
Well, basically, our concern is informed by the fact that certain countries in our African sub-region with significant oil and gas resources have been plagued by the curse of oil. The discovery of oil and exploitation of oil and gas resources has led to armed conflict. It has led to significant macroeconomic challenges. There are health and safety issues and also environmental hazards. And all these things, we believe that when they occur, it's the working people their families, women and children who bear the heaviest burden. So then, when Ghana discovered oil and gas in commercial quantities, we at the TUC decided to engage effectively in the dialogue to ensure that the oil and gas resources become a blessing to the people of Ghana.
Yeah, the concern is that there's been a lot of these discussions prior to even the oil being sold in commercial quantities and all. Has the G2EC waited for all this while to see exactly how things will go before coming in?
No, we have engaged in the dialogue at different levels. So annually we send inputs to the government of Ghana for considerations into the budget, and through those inputs we make our views on what we think should be the best way to go in the management of our oil and gas resources. We have also mixed inputs for considerations into the two bills which were laid before the Parliament of Ghana, which are the Oil Revenue Management Bill and also Petroleum Production and Exploitation Bill. So we have engaged in the dialogue effectively over this year.
Yeah. So what will be different on this occasion?
What is different on this occasion is that we are seeking to bring together all stakeholders in the oil and gas sector at one platform to discuss and engage to find the best way in making sure that Ghana's oil and gas resource remains a blessing to the people of Ghana. So then we'll bring community leaders, and in this case we have Nana Kobnan Ketia, the Omanhini of Eskado traditional area. We'll bring someone from the academia, Professor Kwame Napamfo from the University of Cape Coast. We'll also bring the GMTC. Palu Ghana will be represented, Ghana Gas Company will be there, Ministry of Energy, Ministry of Finance. We have also invited the Public Interest and Accountability Committee. So it's pretty a good platform for all the stakeholders. We also have civil society platform for oil and gas also represented. So what we are seeking to do is that when all these institutions are brought together at a common platform, then they can engage and discuss, share their experiences, share their expectations, share their challenges, and in that we'll be able to find the best way to ensure that oil and gas resources remain a blessing to the people of Ghana.
Yeah, oil has been lifted in commercial quantities for some time now. Do you have any challenge so far?
Our challenge has been the difficulties and sometimes the issues with transparency, the difficulties in assessing information. Also, there have been some concerns about workers' health and safety and all that. Basically, it has been the challenge.
And you aim at addressing all these in your meeting?
Yeah, that is why we carefully selected the relevant stakeholders and try to bring all together under one platform. And then at that platform, we'll be able to air our views and also articulate our points to them.
Normally, when the Ghana TUC gets into anything, people are expecting that you'll be talking about unionization, perhaps the welfare of the workers and all. Have you taken it up since the commercial work started?
Yeah, of course. We have endeavored to organize some workers in the oil and gas sector, and then an affiliate of the TUC, which is the General Transfer Petroleum and Chemical Workers Union, currently has some members even on the oil rig. But we believe that beyond the bread and butter issues that we negotiate for at the enterprise level, policy at the national level can also have an impact on our members. That is why we are seeking to engage at the national level.
Well, Princess Afueji, when exactly is the meeting?
The meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, 22nd to 23rd of November.
We want to thank you very much for sharing all these with us.
Thank you.
Princess Afueji is a researcher of the Ghana TUC. Behind the News, that is where we wrap it all up for today. We want to thank so much George Kwaku, who was at the controls for us. Samuel Esa did the summaries for us. And we also had Edmond Tete, Bright Agama, Chris Tiedu, Ibrahim Asari as part of the production. My name is Kingsley Odinchere.